alcoholic.
Jim.
And I want to thank Tracy for asking me to come out here. Going to Palmdale, that's going to any lengths. I don't know where Lancaster is. It's just a little bit farther, 2.5 hours. But it went by quick with Charlie with me, and started him out with a talk from 1959. And then we started talking, and before long, we were here. If you're new, one, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Two, I want to let you know that, you know, Charlie isn't getting paid, I'm not getting paid, and after you hear my talk, you'll know that for a fact. I'm not a wordsmith like Charlie. I'm surprised I certainly couldn't speak like that with 10 months of sobriety, and that was his first talk ever, so give it up to him, man. I'm an alcoholic, but and I believe in the singleness of purpose of AA, but drugs are a lot of my talk, and I really don't need to apologize for that, because if you grew up in the 60s, 70s, you know, it was, as Sharon Crane says, you know, as this just say thank you generation, and you know, what I am going to do here is for the next 45 minutes, tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I grew up, I was born in Columbus, Ohio, on Columbus Day. My parents were married on Columbus Day. I come from a very famous Italian family, and Columbus Day is a national holiday to us, you know. Now I've got to share it with Indigenous Peoples Day and a few other things, but so growing up, you know, I was at 11 months old, I was run over by a car. My mother left her grocery list in the house and left me in the car, and we lived on a hill, and I managed to release a parking brake, and the door, as the car rolled back, I fell out of the car and the front wheels rolled over me, and you know, they took me to the hospital and they kept me overnight, and there was nothing wrong with me, you know, and I don't remember it, but I heard the story growing up, and you know, I knew I was destined for greatness or infamy or something, you know, I knew I was special, you know, and I think in growing up, you know, watching the gangster movies, you know, Jim Cagney and Humphrey Bogart and everything, and coming from this, you know, very famous Italian family that, you know, I knew someday, you know, some mafia chieftain's daughter would marry me for my last name and I would be a made man. I wanted to be a gangster, you know. My siblings, I'm the youngest, my siblings are overachievers, and I had a learning problem growing up. I didn't know what it was. I didn't learn that it was dyslexia until I came in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and heard it. You know, there's a lot of dyslexic people here, I guess. And, you know, back in, when I was, you know, in elementary school, had a tough time, you know, reading, anything, spelling, anything. And back then they would give you an eye patch. And they'd cover your eye with an eye patch and you walk around like a pirate. But they did a new treatment on me where they dilated one eye before I went to school. So I had one eye dilated and one eye regular, and that was supposed to help. I don't know if it ever did, but, you know, they just kind of just passed me along. And so instead of, you know, being good at school, I was really good at being bad at school. And in third grade, where most little boys are, you know, running around playing, I was mischievous. My mother was PTA president that year, you know, treasurer of the cafeteria, and, you know, and I managed to, I liked going dumpster diving, And, you know, there was like a hospital down near our house, and I used to go dumpster diving in the medical waste and, you know, pull up, you know, syringes. You know, they made great squirt guns, and, you know, you'd go up and down the street, and, you know, going through people's trash, and every once in a while you'd get the holy grail of dumpster diving as a third grader, a Playboy magazine, you know. And, so, you know, of course, you know, I want to share my finds, you know, and I'd bring them into school, and I got kicked out of school for bringing pornography to third grade class, you know, and expelled for that. And it didn't get any better, you know. And so, you know, my first drink was, you know, grew up in the San Fernando Valley. Bought one of the first track houses on the hillside there. You know, so everybody had a game room, you know, and with a little bar, and, you know, so mixing drinks with my friends, and, you know, being drunk or pretending to be drunk, you know, at 9, 10 years old, and that was my first drink. But my dad was a senior vice president for a big corporation, and every time that corporation would buy a new division, he was put in charge of finance for it. So we started moving when I was 12 years old. The first move was to Cleveland, Ohio, and you know, it didn't take me long there. 1968, Summer of Love, 13 years old. You know, I was already looking for, you know, something. And I found it there. The first month in school, I was invited to a party. And, you know, I'm the cool kid from California. I can't go to the party empty-handed. So I managed to find some LSD. And I took my first hit of acid and went to a Jesus freak party. It was actually Young Life. It was you know, it was not a good trip, let me tell you. I managed to, you know, in that school, you know, got arrested for selling weed at 15, and, you know, eventually after 3 years my dad got transferred back out here, and now I'm going to Taft High School. And in Taft High School in Woodland Hills, you know, the same thing. You know, I did not study. I did not take books home. I never missed school. I had a great time in school. I was high all the time. You know, drugs were a lot easier to get than alcohol, you know, but I would certainly drink any chance I got. You know, and then the next move was to Chicago. And by the time I got to Chicago, I was going for my senior year. They would not let me. I went to one semester, and they would not let me finish my senior year in that high school. That's how I showed up at a new school. And they let me take night school, and I would get the same diploma. So that allowed me during the day to get a job, and I got a job at a hospital supply warehouse. Beautiful job. I would throw cases of, you know, 5,000 syringes. By this time, I'm an intravenous drug user. I'm 17 years old in Chicago. I've got a fake ID for 19, 18, and 21, because in Chicago, where we were living, Northwest, it was a very quick drive to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, you could drink anything for 18. And Lake Geneva was famous for the Playboy Club, but in the town of Lake Geneva, it was bar, 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 store, bar, bar, bar. And, you know, they would have dime shorties, you know, 10 cents for an 8-ounce glass of beer, 50-cent shots of tequila, and I had a great time. I learned how to drink really well there. And then the other IDs in Illinois at the time, 19 beer and wine and 21 for hard liquor. So that's why I had three sets of IDs. And back then, they didn't have pictures. You know, you just kind of like, you know, you could alter them all you wanted. So I ended up leaving Chicago as soon as I graduated high school. Got on an airplane with another friend, took a hit of acid, and flew back to Los Angeles. I arrived in Los Angeles not really, you know, knowing what I was going to do, and I fell into a very lucrative career right off the gate. It was avocado wrestling. And I'd drive up to Santa Barbara and drop, you know, burlap sacks and boxes in an orchard and then park the car away and, you know, get high and pick avocados all day and then come at night and pick them up. And there's a place called Topanga Canyon where all the hippies were at that time. And there was a lot of health food stores there, and I was selling bulk avocados to all the health food stores. I had a avocado stand on Mulholland in Topanga. Of course, they were organic, if they asked me. I really didn't know, and you know, I could undercut anybody's price, very low overhead, and that got me. There was a commune in Topanga that was buying bulk food from this health food store called Fruit Chakra, and they wanted to meet me because they wanted bulk avocados. And so I met them, and they had an opening in their commune. It was a non-smoking vegetarian commune, which I was none of that. But I looked the part, you know. I was sucked up, I had a beard, I had long hair, and I moved right in. And they were in the process of building an elliptical dome there, and they had a good amount of land there. And I would use their car to go down into the valley at night, and I'd get drunk down in the valley and then drive back and stop at Jack in the Box and get a couple Jumbo Jacks on the way. And they were building this elliptical dome, and I had to contribute 20 hours a week of work, you know, and I didn't like getting up in the morning and milking goats. I didn't mind tending the horses, but so I saw this one book they had. It said, Build a Yurt. And I was like, I could do that. And so that's what I did for a good portion of the time. I built this yurt, had got busted by the building department, so I had to draw up plans for it. And as far as building and safety, is the first Americanized yurt in Southern California. And I ended up living in it. And one night, coming back from a bluegrass concert with one of the founders of the commune, Malibu sheriffs had surrounded the compound, and as we pulled up, they arrested me for direct sales of cocaine and sales of marijuana. So the gig was up, and back then, people were getting some heavy time for joints, you know, and I was facing 10 years. My parents were still in the mood to help Jim out, and they got me a very good lawyer, and I got 5 years joint suspended, 5 years formal probation, and the commune liked me so much they let me come back, and I stayed there, and I did a few geographics back. By this time, my parents were living in Maryland, and I would go back and forth, but eventually, you know, the debris rolls to the sea, and I went from Topanga to Venice Beach. And I got to Venice Beach around 1978, and it was like the Wild West, and I finally found my people. And I got an apartment down there a block off the beach. It was $135 a month. I paid first and last and never paid another dime and lived there for years. It was great. It was great living. I never worked. There was one time the LA Times wrote up an article about our apartment building, you know, and had a picture of the entrance to the building, you know, with the mailboxes torn down and the front door hanging. And it said, Venice occupants, Mar neighborhood. Occupants of this building are derelicts, degenerates, disease-ridden people, some of whom are violent and dangerous. You know, and went on to describe the occupants and about how the building next door caught on fire because somebody threw a burning mattress off the roof. And you know, I thought it was great. I made copies and sent it to my parents, and this is where I'm living, you know. And I kind of thought of myself as like, you know, like a writer, you know, or something, you know, even though I couldn't write or spell. But, you know, I was thinking this is, you know, great. I'm hanging out with people, you know, nobody had real names there. You know, it was, you know, Dump Truck Mary, you know, Acid John, you know, Topanga Dave, Donkey Dan DiCarlo, who was, if you ever seen Helter Skelter, he was of the Manson fame, you know, a straight Satan who turned evidence against Charlie. You know, just all these just wild characters, you know. And, you know, there's a, you know, a local bike gang there that, you know, I came riding in on a motorcycle. Anyway, it was exciting. There was never a dull moment. And, you know, every morning I woke up and I'd go down to the beach. We had our own, you know, little pagoda, you know, where we all hung out. And you know, we'd peddle drugs and drink each morning, you know. And sometimes if we didn't have any drugs to sell, we'd find something to sell to the tourists, you know. You take some taco sauce and drip it on some paper and sell it as blotter acid, you know, whatever you could sell, you know. And, you know, I mean, I did everything possible, you know, to keep my alcohol intake and drugs intake in, you know. I literally, you know, I would get counterfeit money fronted to me, and this was like just stuff they must have swept off the floor, you know. It was so bad. And I mean, I would lay it out and take hairspray and have to spray them down both sides just to get them so they wouldn't, you know, feel somewhat natural. And, you know, drive up the coast and you know, buy a case of Heineken at every liquor store going up the coast and using a $100 bill and getting change. And that was before those little pens came out, you know. I remember the first time I saw one of those pens come out, I was like, oh, this gig's up. And, you know, that was my life, you know. I didn't have, you know, no ambition, didn't, you know, I never had my driver's license would always be yanked or I wouldn't have one, drunk drivings all the time. I was getting years for drunk drivings. I got hooked up with somebody that taught me how to make master keys, double-sided keys for imported cars. You know, if the key opened up the door, it would turn the ignition over. And a lot of times you would get the door open, get the key in the ignition, the key would get stuck in there, but at least the car was driving. And so I started stealing cars. And soon it made a lot of sense to me because the first time I got pulled over in a stolen car, now I never was mildly intoxicated. I was always, you know, three sheets to the wind, always loaded, always going to get a drunk driving if they caught me behind the wheel. First time I got pulled over in my car of choice, 240Z, I got pulled over in one and they arrested me for Grand Theft Auto, which is a felony, and they don't bother charging you with a misdemeanor drunk driving. You know, they got you for a felony. Why bother with that? And because the key's stuck in the ignition, you know, it's dropped down to joyriding, and I get 30 days. And I thought, this is great. If I wasn't driving a stolen car, I'd be getting a year or more. And I swore to myself I would never drive a legit car again. And so that's kind of how I first came to you. One of my friends who was living under an alias when he got sober, I knew his real name, and he brought me into the group in 1984, and I managed to stay sober for 30 days. I was there for the last cake that Chuck Chamberlain gave Clancy, and somehow, you know, I ended up going back out, and I went back out for another 9 months before I actually got sober in 1985. But during that 9 months, I made a few different trips to jail, and one of them, I was driving a legit car, and I got pulled over. Now, I knew I had warrants, but the guy that got me sober, I knew his alias. I knew everything about it. I even knew the guy he stole the alias from. So I used his name. And lo and behold, that sober member of AA still had 3 drinking in public tickets that he didn't pay for. So I got arrested underneath his name. I got a connection to bail me out. I showed up at his place, and I produced paperwork. Of course, I was driving a new stolen car. I had lots of paperwork, license plates, and I had a pink slip with his alias on it. And I, you know, told him that, you know, I just cleared up your name. You know, you're going to have to pay me for that. And, you know, as a good member of AA, he negotiated me down, I think, to 50%. And so that's how I operated. So sometime around June, things were going pretty good for me. I was I could see the boats of the Marina del Rey out of the window of my home. My home consisted of a camper shell that was set on a flatbed tractor trailer hauler that I had stolen. They just leave them around after they take the bulldozer off. They're just sitting around asking to be taken. You just have to have the right hitch. And the camper shell came off a stolen truck I'd stolen. And I was living there, and I had this truck sitting there. I was parked right by Bruffy's Tow Yard in the marina, and the sheriffs every 3 or 4 days would come around and make me move my motorhome. And that morning, I had woken up, no money in my pocket, which wasn't unusual, but I had a gold tooth. I don't know where I got it from, and I went to Gold Exchange in Santa Monica, and I got $8 for it. And I bought 2 tall Budweisers. I went back to my little home there. I drank one of them, and it didn't, you know, I don't know if it just didn't work for me, but I laid back down. And that morning, I got the knock from the sheriffs, and it took me a while to get to the door, and I had a truck sitting there, and I had kind of legit plates on it, but I had put a stolen stereo in this stolen truck, and then somebody stole it. And so there's wires hanging down, and so the police were looking at the truck, you know, and by the time I stashed my weapon and I came to the door, I wasn't wearing a shirt, but I neglected to take the 175 car keys off my ring. And by this time, they were running the VIN number on the truck, and once again, they arrested me for Grand Theft Auto. And, you know, all my possessions, I don't know where they ended up. And I went to jail. And, you know, it wasn't like, you know, I saw a flash of light and my lifestyle, my drinking led me to this. It's always going to be like this. No, I was in jail. I got out of jail. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. And I kind of stick out downtown. Men's County Jail, I don't think it's there anymore. And I went out to the parking lot. I was going to steal a motorcycle. And then I kind of had a little thought that, you know, it's probably a cop's bike. And I went back in and I made a collect call. There was no cell phones in 1985. And phones, you know, unless you really took the trouble to unplug them, you know, you couldn't really turn them off. And the only phone number I knew was that guy that had gotten me sober the year before. And he was still in AA, still under an alias, mind you. He didn't clear that up for 6 years, but he was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew enough about AA for the 30 days I was in. I knew the responsibility, the code that you have, that we are always, you know, to be there for the alcoholic who cries out. You know, I knew I had him. You know, if I just called him and said, "Hey, I want to get sober," he'd have to come and pick me up, or he might drink. You know, and so I told him, "Yeah, I'm willing to do anything. You know, I just wanted to get back to Venice and find somebody who owed me some money." And so he picked me up. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning by the time he got me. He got me something to eat, and we went to a 6:45 attitude adjustment meeting, and then to another meeting that night. We were staying at his sister's house. He was on the couch. He still hadn't, you know, gotten everything back yet, and I was sleeping on the floor. And you know, I went to, you know, two meetings a day for the first 2 weeks of sobriety, and he got me in a 30-day program, which I went through and got out, and I got, you know, just pushed into this group, you know, you know, some of you know the Pacific group. I don't usually mention that when I speak. They kind of know because I'm wearing a coat and tie, but you know, the group is very active. And they just kind of pull you along. I don't believe I could have gotten sober in any other group. I would have been the, you know, sitting in the back and, you know, leaving at the break or doing something. But, you know, these people, I fell into a group, you know, and I got some friends. You know, I got a job working at a rib house, you know, taking orders over the phone and getting one meal a shift. I was taking a couch commitment where, you know, the people let you stay on their couch for a short term, and you have to leave when they leave, and you can't come back until after the end of the meeting, you know. And I started working this rib house, couch commitment, and a friend of mine who I used to sell drugs to, he had gotten sober a few months before me, and he went off to a trade school. And that trade school was for plumbing. Damn, if he would have gone off to medical school, I could have been a gynecologist today or something. You know, but I'm a plumber. You know, I like Larry. You know, Larry says, you know, I used to think about, you know, AA pulled me out of the gutter to put me in the sewer. You know, and you know, and I kind of thrived, you know. I went to this trade school, you know, not really learning much, but it got my foot in the door. And I remember going to a field trip for that plumbing school. I didn't have a car or anything or a driver's license, and so I had to ride with some guys, and they were smoking pot. And I remember just driving all the way down to the Hyperium treatment plant, with my head out the window, you know, because I didn't even want to, you know, possibly get any kind of contact high, you know. You know, that was a big field trip. If you don't know, the Hyperion treatment plant is where all the poop in Los Angeles goes to. What an adventure. And so, you know, I got into this group and got very active, got involved in H&I, got a sponsor, started working the steps. Started sponsoring some guys, very involved in H&I, got my own panel, and somewhere in the, when I was about 2 years sober, I was asked to go on a panel to Wayside, and I thought, yeah, sure. And so we all met at a location, we all drove together to go to Wayside, and Charlie, can I have that water? We got down there, and this was, you know, 36 years ago or so. And you would go in, and it was Wayside Max, which I had spent a lot of time at Wayside Max because I could never show up for my court dates, and they'd put a no bail warrant on me, and I'd end up there. So back then, you would just surrender your driver's license to the little guard post when you walked in the door, and that's what I did. And I went out there, and I spoke to these convicts, you know, telling them how great it is to be on this side of the table instead of sitting there in those funny orange jumpsuits and everything. And, you know, we finished our talk and we went back out, get our driver's license to leave. And they gave out all the driver's license to everybody except me and said, "Are you Andrew Borghese? Live at 672 Flower Avenue?" And I was like, for a brief moment, I was thinking, how does he remember me from the thousands of people that go through here? How does he remember me? And he goes, "You have a warrant." And I'm like, "I don't have any warrants." You know, and sure enough, they were saying I had a warrant, and they let the other panelists go, and you know, they had me up against the wall, you know, doing another pat down just as they marched the inmates, you know, out of the room, and some wise ass, "Keep coming back." You know, that afternoon before going on that panel, I was working for a plumbing shop. I was driving the plumbing truck back to the shop, knowing I had this panel. Somebody ran a stop sign and center punched the van. I brought the guy back to the plumbing shop so my boss would know I didn't have anything to do with it. Then I go on this panel. I get arrested. They can't put me in general population. I'm talking to the guy. I finally convince him that I don't have a warrant. And he goes, "Okay, if you can get someone to come and pick you up," because the panelists had already left and there's no cell phones. "Hey, come back and get me." So I had to call somebody from Santa Monica to drive out to get me. By the time they got back to the jail, a new watch commander came on. Now, I guess in 1987, the computers were not what they are today, because when it was printing out my rap sheet, the computer froze and broke. And so they couldn't check on the warrant or check on it. The new watch commander comes in and he looks at, you know, three quarters of my rap sheet, and there's an assault with a deadly weapon on police officers or firemen, and he's like, "I can't let you go." You know, I tried to explain to him I was throwing a Mickey's Big Mouth bottle at my hooker girlfriend down at the beach, and it happened to explode by some cops, and they, you know, arrested me for it. But he didn't understand, and so they transported me to a substation. I got somebody else to come to the substation and bail me out. I went to the same plumbing shop that morning, didn't have much sleep, same truck, took a left in to get some coffee in a Jaguar, pulled up in the far lane and hit me. This time it was my fault. So in 24 hours, I got in two major accidents and went to jail on an AA panel. And I managed to stay sober, and I thought, you know what? I can stay sober through anything. And, time is up almost. Anyway, I got, you know, 35 years to tell you that, you know, through Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a great life today. I, you know, ended up getting married. That didn't work out. I got two beautiful sons from that wedding, or from that marriage. And, you know, I, you know, was able to buy property in Santa Monica. And I've lived in the same house for 28 years. Just through consistency of being able to show up for, you know, AA commitments, you know, the consistency of showing up at a meeting when you say you're going to do it. Bring that into your work life. Bring it into my personal life. You know, I believe, you know, you see that circle and the triangle. If you're new, it's unity, service, and recovery, the three side of the triangle. I also have my own triangle, you know, where it's, you know, work, family, and AA, you know, and you keep all those things balanced. And, you know, because if you do too much work, you know, your family or your AA life's going to suffer, you know, and And you know, it's held me in good stead. I after my divorce, I'd done a lot of traveling when I was using. I didn't, you know, going to Lincoln Boulevard was a far trip for me, and I got to do a lot of traveling. I got involved with the Sober Club Med guys there, and I was doing the Sober Club Med photograph for them every, you know, twice a year, going to the Caribbean and Mexico, and I got the travel bug. I was able to go to, you know, ride camels along the Great Pyramids of Giza, and, you know, ski in the Alps, and, you know, and after my divorce, one of my friends said, "Hey, you want to go to Thailand?" And I don't know. And I went to Thailand, and you know, I fell in love, went there a couple more times for the convention out there, and fell in love with the people. Certainly probably the best destination place I'd ever been to as far as monetary. And also fell in love with the women, and I was able to. Clancy ended up speaking at the roundup out there after I'd been there probably 20, 25 times, and married a Thai gal, brought her back here. You know, we've been married now 18 years, and it was kind of very, very problematic bringing somebody. I mean, she had never been on an airplane before. She, you know, college graduate, but grew up in a remote village in Isan, Thailand, where for our wedding, me and seven of my friends, we were the first white men ever to enter the village, and a wedding off the pages of National Geographic, you know, where the monks come in from the temple and there's a whole ceremony, then the elders take over and the giving of the sin sod of, you know, cash and gold and, you know, like a reverse dowry. And, you know, so Clancy was speaking at the roundup, so I was able to take him around Thailand, and I got to, you know, he wasn't very patient, you know, riding in a van for a long time. And, you know, there's 10 of us in this van. And, you know, I took him to the floating market. And then, you know, he's like, "Rawr," you know, I finally get to it. He's like, "Clancy, we're here." He's like, "Where's here?" I go, "Right there, the bridge on the River Kwai." And, you know, he was in World War II. And, you know, there's a lot of history from World War II in Thailand. And you know, one of my favorite photographs from that trip is Clancy with my wife, just choking my wife out on the bridge. You know? He said he mistaken her for a Japanese, but I don't believe it. And, you know, so, 2 minutes, I got you. And I was, you know, brought her here. You know, and I thought we'd have trouble. Definitely we did have trouble. You know, she was cold in Indian summer in October. And, you know, and then, you know, I just had bought a house in Mammoth. And, you know, I like to ski. And, you know, she was cold at, you know, 75 degrees, you know. And then extremely jealous, you know. And we're in, you know, I'm taking her to AA meetings where, you know, I dated half the crazy women in AA after my divorce before I went to Thailand. And so, you know, that was a problem. And luckily my sponsor, he was very active, not only in Alcoholics Anonymous, but also in the program of Al-Anon. And I knew right where to take her. And she's celebrated 18 years in Al-Anon. And she's got a very, they have a very strong Al-Anon program, which is our sister program there, stepped up group, and they work the steps, and they're even more serious than we are about their program. And you know, now at 68, I've got a 7-year-old, you know, so I'm starting all over. But you know, life is good. I'm trying to retire, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to soon. My oldest son ran off after 10 years of working for me, and ran off to Texas and joined the Texas Army National Guard. And he likes guns more than he likes plumbing, I guess. But I want to thank you all for listening. And if you're new, you have fallen into a great group here. As Clancy used to say, a pocket of enthusiasm. And just stick to it. Thank you. All right.